I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today we're going to take into a little dive into social history during the period of Stalinism. I find this fascinating, the impact of these massive, often traumatic transitions that you find in authoritarian societies, be they Stalinist or fascist or what have you, the impact that that has on family life, the way in which men and women behave towards one another, the way in which children are brought up, the way in which the circumstances in which families exist. And we're going to look again at Sheila Fitzpatrick's Everyday Stalinism today, and look at the question of family life, and principally of the behaviour of absconding husbands during the Stalin era. And Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "The early 1930s were a period of great disruption and upheaval in Soviet society. Thus, it is not surprising that the family was shaken too, just as it had been during the Civil War. Millions of men left home during collectivisation. Some kept in touch with their families in the village, others did not. Divorce was easy. One urban respondent in the Harvard Project was a series of interviews that ran from 1951 to 1953, interviewing Soviet emigres, those who in one way or another had managed to leave the Soviet Union. One respondent mentioned in the 1930s there being an epidemic of divorces, and in any case there had been no pressure to register marriages. The incredible difficulty of urban housing conditions forced families into miserably confined spaces and contributed to the high rate of desertion by husbands, especially after the birth of a child. Almost 10 million women entered the labour market for the first time in the course of the 1930s, and many of them ended up as the sole breadwinner for families that consisted of a mother, one or two children, and the irreplaceable babushka, or grandmother, who ran the household. The task of women, of the woman breadwinner, was not made easier by the fact that women tend to be clustered in low-skilled and low-paying jobs." So, there is a direct economic impact on families throughout the twin process of collectivisation in the countryside and forced industrialisation, state-led industrialisation in the towns and cities. Rapid industrialisation in many places that it's been tried throughout the world very often leads to slum conditions. Towns and cities that develop new industries act like magnets to a rural population who move there as quickly as possible in order to access better standards of employment, better paid employment, and imagine that they will access better living conditions. But the very fact that normally even the most proactive, even the most involved activist state finds it difficult without significant run-up in terms of house building to provide enough new flats, apartments, even barracks in some cases, means that one either has, as you get in certain parts of the developing world, shanty towns emerging, or in the case of the Soviet Union, ever greater concentrations of people crammed into housing blocks and crammed into the homes which were originally designed for one family. The Bolsheviks began the tradition of socialising all housing immediately after the revolution, but this is continued by Stalin, cramming in as many families as possible. It served a number of purposes. It meant that there was no privacy, and privacy was seen as a particularly bad thing by the regime. Privacy was the state in which one could have subversive conversations or hidden secret conversations or not be overheard. And also it meant that there was a focus on enjoying or accessing public space, so people's leisure time might be spent in a more communal environment, and this was a way of kind of emphasising the collective over the private or the individual. But the reality, more than anything else, was that building factories and railways and mines and dams was important for the regime. Providing accommodation for the workers was much, much less of a priority. And this is entirely contradictory with the period of the second five-year plan, where Stalin wanted to focus more on living standards and the idea that life had become more joyous, comrades. Now, the difficulties that most families faced were compounded by families that had a social stigma attached to them. Now, if you go back in previous podcasts, I've talked a lot about how families were associated with the social or political or ideological sins of their parents, how people with kulak backgrounds or former people backgrounds, i.e. those who'd been a part of the bourgeoisie or the upper classes or the church or the army or the Tsarist administration before the revolution, how those people, their family history followed them around, and it was very difficult to falsify records and quite risky to bury one's past. Children might be sent away to protect them from the taint of poor family history, so you might send them to a relative that has kind of dodged that bullet, rather. Or they might feel obliged to, some of the children often felt obliged to keep their distance from their own parents for much the same reason. Children that wanted to be in the Young Pioneers or the Komsomol, or who wanted not to be victimised at school. Deportations and exile sometimes actually kept families together, whether they wanted it or not. But often, one or more family members would manage to kind of escape the sentence. So mothers and fathers might be sent away, children might be left behind, or elder siblings might be left behind. And one surefire way to do this was to denounce parents. The story of Pavlik Morozov that becomes almost like a folk tale in Soviet Russia is a key example. For those that haven't heard the story before, Comrade Pavlik was a young pioneer who denounced his father. His father was sent away to hard labour in the Gulag, and Pavlik, before he could be rewarded by the state, was murdered by angry relatives. And the story was told through Soviet media as the martyrdom of a good Soviet citizen, not as a kind of a loathsome, ghastly child who had sent his father off to a lifetime of torment, but that evil counter-revolutionaries had murdered this child who had placed the collective, the state, and society beyond his own selfish needs to have parents. and who saw the wider collective as the real kind of social body to which he belonged. So Pavlik Morozov was seen, presented as a hero. I'm not entirely sure how many Soviet citizens genuinely sympathised with him. My guess is probably not all that many. So families were torn to shreds by the purges, which often either left deaths in the family, or family members stigmatised and associated with being enemies of the people. Often when male party members or victims of the purges were denounced, their wives would be sent to the camps. Perhaps the husband would be executed and the wives would be sent to the camps on the belief that, well, they must have been having similar sorts of conversations secretly and privately whilst they were married. The children in question would either be farmed out to relatives or sent to Soviet orphanages, which is a particularly unpleasant fate for the children that went there. They would often have their names changed, perhaps if they were too young to remember who their real parents were. And one could only imagine what a terribly traumatic experience for children that must have been. Sheila Fitzpatrick presents a different view of Soviet society, however, from this kind of conventional model. She says, "There's another side to the story, namely the resilience of the family. At the most basic level, people continued to get married. The Soviet urban marriage rate remained very high by both pre-war and contemporary European standards, especially assuming that not all the de facto marriages were registered. In 1937, 91% of all men aged 30 to 39 and 82% of women reported themselves married. In some respects, the uncertain and dangerous conditions of life in the 1930s seemed to make families stronger as their members drew closer together for self-protection. The Soviet Union is a mass of individual family units isolated from each other," one Harvard Project respondent from the intelligentsia said. "Families are not broken up. Rather, they try to draw close to each other. We lived separately before, but after the revolution, we all came together," said another respondent from the same social group. "We talked freely, only in our own family. In difficult times, we came together." So this idea of speaking freely, Orlando Feige's book The Whisper is all about the idea that in the Soviet society, in everyday life in the Soviet Union, people whispered to make sure the neighbours didn't hear, but they also whispered to one another as a kind of act of intimacy, of passing together ideas that perhaps the state didn't like very much. And here, in a similar vein, Sheila Fitzpatrick is talking about the idea that in the family unit was the one place where one could trust, where one cannot allow oneself to trust anybody else outside the family. But families actually gel together more closely because that's where secrets and ideas and beliefs can be openly articulated. So this is precisely the opposite of what the regime initially, in the post-revolutionary years, the immediate post-revolutionary years, wanted. Initially, Lenin saw the family as being a bourgeois institution, a product of bourgeois class relations, and something that would eventually be unnecessary. Eventually, men and women would live in dormitories and children would be brought up in creches, and a new kind of proletarian organisation for human beings would emerge, and it would be kind of more rational and more suited to industrial life, really more suited to the extraction of labour from workers.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring.
At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And the anticipated end of the family was more part of a kind of regimentation of individuals in the interests of extracting labour from them more than anything else. Any kind of emancipatory part of the Bolshevik programme seems by this measure to have been dead by about 1919. The irony here is, of course, the repression of the state made families stronger units and made families more likely to be more resilient. The Harvard Project revealed that the families of the intelligentsia seemed to coalesce more closely together, but the families of blue-collar workers were less likely to do that. And the reason why is possibly that the problems of poverty that were met by almost all strata of Soviet society, except for those who were in the higher echelons of the party during the 1930s, were more likely to impact on industrial working class families. And those families, the tensions of poverty perhaps created obstacles to family cohesion during that time. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "There's no doubt that the impact of Soviet conditions on the family could be contradictory. Consider the example of Stefan Podlyubny, son of a dekulakized Ukrainian peasant, who went to Moscow with his mother after his father's arrest at the beginning of the 1930s. Podlyubny was extremely close to his mother, with whom he lived, and felt a great loyalty to her. When she was arrested in 1937, his faith in the Soviet regime was seriously shaken. With his father, it was the opposite. They were pulled apart, not only geographically, but also psychologically, as Podlyubny tried to make himself into a good Soviet citizen and push his father and his father's anger out of mind." So I suppose in that particular case, it does depend on what the familial relations were like in the first place, a weak connection with the father, or a fear of the father, or a relationship that is perhaps damaging or harmful, a parental relationship that's perhaps damaging or harmful, might be changed by state intervention, i.e. the arrest of a father on supposed political crimes. That actually might be greeted with some degree of enthusiasm by family members. There's a really interesting study in The Third Reich at War by Richard J. Evans, in which he discusses the means by which often unhappy marriages came to an end through the use of denunciation, that wives who were fed up with their husbands would simply tell the Gestapo that the husband had been saying defeatist things about Germany at war, or had been ridiculing the Führer. When you have the state as a major actor in the lives of individuals, individuals will of course use the state in all manner of ways. They may choose to cooperate in the way that the state intended, or they may kind of subvert state repression to their own ends through denunciation. Divorce was a key part of survival strategies in order to ensure that one partner who might be likely to be denounced would then not be responsible for the well-being or the ideological behaviour of another. If one partner is denounced, the other can say, well, look, I divorced him or I divorced her years ago, and the reason I did is because, and they could invent this part, say, well, I knew they had counter-revolutionary ideas and I didn't like them very much, so that's why I got rid of them. Often these divorced couples were perfectly happy and lived together. They had just formally kind of dissolved their marriage to protect themselves. And in many cases, at least one spouse survived if the other was arrested around 1937 or 1938. Families would have several generations within them cohabiting during the 1930s. There would often be, based around a matriarchy, with several generations of women as the core of the family in terms of family organisation, the management of money, the care of children, and the management of male behaviour, ensuring that there was not too much alcohol or violence or philandering or any of these other things that men might possibly be guilty of doing in difficult family circumstances. In a family situation where several generations might exist in one apartment to be crammed in, there might be aunts and uncles and other distant relatives, there might only be one legal resident of the apartment. One person is actually allowed to live there, and the rest are simply relatives who have found it convenient to squeeze in. In these circumstances, there was either immense conflict for scarce resources, space and that kind of thing within the family, or there was a great deal of kind of cooperation and a sense of shared ownership or kind of communality in the face of adversity. Often the families would be top-heavy with women because it was more likely that men would be arrested, sent away, the victims of either some sort of police action mounting up to the Great Purge, or possibly some kind of deportation, deculacization, something like that. Not to say that significant numbers of women weren't involved in that, but it was disproportionately men who were affected. You were more likely to be deported or arrested if you were male. The views of the family that the revolutionary intelligentsia brought with them into government following the October Revolution, the rejection of the family as being a kind of like a bourgeois institution, and these sort of more bohemian attitudes towards sex, sexuality, towards women's rights to choose what they do with their own bodies, these begin to kind of dry up in the mid-1920s. Lenin was far less the kind of libertarian than some kind of some of his supporters have implied. Far more often, there was a kind of a great deal of social conservatism that existed amongst the Bolsheviks, and the brief period of sexual liberation did not survive into the 1930s. There were many women within the party that believed in gender equality and saw gender oppression as part of class struggle, which is a kind of a fairly a reasonable position to take. But for the wider population, attitudes towards gender did not significantly change in the post-revolutionary years. There was some tension between the idea put forward by Soviet education and the Komsomol and the Young Pioneers, that there was something shameful about being an uneducated woman, or growing up from being a girl without an education to being a woman who was simply a housewife, and not becoming someone who learned and worked for the new state and society. And the reality of not only pre-existing social conservatism within Russia, but also a kind of a focus on family values that actually emerges during the 1930s, where the idea of the Soviet woman at home as the domestic homemaker becomes more and more popular and more and more important in Stalin's eyes as one of the kind of the linchpins of social stability. In the later years of the 1920s, there was active campaign against abortion. There were unfavourable noises about divorce that were made by Stalin in Pravda and the other organs of the Soviet press. And certainly sexual promiscuity and sexual liberation were seen as being fundamentally bad things. Soviet laws on divorce, alimony, property rights and inheritance were all based on ideas around family mutual responsibility, that families should actually stay together to look after one another. So by the late 1920s and early 1930s, the original ideas of breaking families up in the interests of social revolution had almost been completely expunged. And now social conservatism was what would determine the legal standing of the family. But the economics of family life, the shortages, the housing shortages, having to cram people into ever smaller amounts of accommodation in order to survive, that is what would create the social reality of Soviet family life. Anyway, I hope you found this interesting and useful. Normally, I would say, do remember to subscribe to the podcast or follow us on Patreon or anything like that. Please don't. Just go and do one thing for me today. If you are listening here in the UK, or you know, wherever you are in the world, but particularly here in the UK, please register to vote. If you don't register to vote, then the kind of conditions that I've just been describing in this podcast will, not the purges, but certainly the housing shortages and the miseries of everyday life, will be visited upon us very, very soon. Please register to vote and cast your vote wisely. Go and do it today. If you go to .gov.uk, it takes a couple of minutes. Thanks very much, and I'll keep badgering on about that for the next couple of weeks until December the 12th. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow-up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OSEAMalibu.com, code GLOW.